We want to thank our sponsors of this special on-location visit to Normandy, France, DAV of Minnesota, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580, and Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. We're continuing our commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and we are recording live on location in Sainte-Marie-Glise. I'm joined by my co-hosts, the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, and noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. Just want to kind of set the stage here. I'm standing in the town square of Sainte-Marie-Glise. We're just west of Utah Beach. And, gentlemen, this is a pretty significant location. This was a priority for the Allied forces to take control of. It had a major impact, or would have a major impact, on what would then happen later in the morning on D-Day. So, Doug, I want to start with you maybe and just kind of tell us or set the stage. Why was this town so strategically important for the Allied forces?
This town was going to be the center point for cutting off German reinforcements from coming to Utah Beach. And Utah Beach had exits off of the beach, four exits that needed to be protected from German counterattacks. These exits were going to be the only way that Allied or American armor and vehicles and troops were going to be able to get inland. Protecting those causeways was the main objective of the airborne forces that dropped here in this area. Not only this town of Sainte-Marie-Glise, but several other towns around the area that provided a much-needed strategic plan for protecting those exits off the beach.
And Dominic, when we look at the location of where we're at, and we're on the peninsula of Cointon, what were the Allied forces trying to protect based on the location where we are in this peninsula? What was north of us?
The north of this location was Cherbourg, a big harbor, which was the objective on D-Day. But also, there was a lot of German troops. And as said, it was very important to control this crossroad, which was Sainte-Marie-Glise, to protect against this reinforcement of German who can arrive from the north. So that's the reason why Sainte-Marie-Glise, it was not the town who was important, it was this crossroad, to take this crossroad to let the troops arriving at Utah Beach, a 4th Infantry Division, to be able to go inland, to cut the peninsula, and then to go north to liberate, to take Cherbourg.
And so, obviously, we are inland. We know what was going to be happening later in the day as the beaches were about to be have landings on the beaches. Somehow, some way, Doug, we needed to get forces here to secure this area, to secure the causeways, to block so that the Germans couldn't reinforce. How is it that the Allied forces were going to get here into this area?
Well, they needed to drop two airborne divisions. The 82nd and the 101st Airborne had different objectives. The way they got them here was with a fleet of over 800 C-47 aircraft. These aircraft were the workhorses of the Army Air Corps. They were transport planes, and they were troop carrier personnels. Each one of these 800 plus C-47s carried what was called a stick, or a plane load of over 20 fully armed and highly trained paratroopers. They would come in over the drop zones at between 300 and 500 feet and exit the planes and drop onto those all-important drop zones so they could form together in units and go to the different objectives that they needed to capture, including this important crossroad towns of Sainte-Marie-Glise.
And we have a specific Minnesota service member who is from Little Falls, Minnesota, that was a pilot of one of those planes. Can you tell us a little bit about this person?
Sure. This is Norm Arvidson, and as you said, he's from Little Falls, Minnesota. Norm had the distinction of being one of the few few C-47 pilots that made four major airborne landings in World War II. This was his third airborne drop. He was a very well-seasoned pilot. Some of the pilots that came in weren't that well seasoned. There were some issues later on with missed drop zones, and there were some problems with those later drops. Norm happened to be one of the very first C-47s to take off from Grenham Common in England early in the morning. His drop was actually fairly unopposed, so Norm dropped paratroopers north of Saint-Mary-Glis, and his connection to history was when that famous photograph of Eisenhower speaking to the paratroopers before they took off from D-Day was at the airfield that Norm was at. So Norm witnessed history that day too when he saw General Eisenhower speaking with these paratroopers that were about to embark for Normandy.
And so, Dom, you know, the aircraft, the hundreds of aircraft are coming over. They're going to drop our paratroopers. Were there some serious concerns on the ground, however? What did it look like here in the terms of, like, anti-aircraft and things like that that they would have to maneuver around or through?
Yes, just here in this location, there was an anti-aircraft battery, 88 millimeters, and there was a unit of the Luftwaffe who was here near Fauville, where there was the headquarters. So the troops at Saint-Mary-Glis were all troops working for this anti-aircraft. And also, there was something happened that day. There was on this night, the local villagers had been allowed to break the curfew in order to help put out a house fire next to the square. And the church bell tolled, announcing to the villagers that help was needed in the square. Under the watchful gaze of the German troops from the local garrison, the villagers formed a human chain at a nearby water pump and began passing buckets of water along towards the firemen that were tackling the raging fire. At the same time, upon wave of Dakota were flying overhead and began dropping their loads of paratroopers. As the men of the Hef Company began dropping in the square, the German sentries instantly opened fire. Instinctively, the villager began running to cover. As a stick of paratrooper landed in the town square, the German began shooting them before they could release themselves from their parachute harness.
And so, you know, we reference the movie The Longest Day. I think it had great depiction about the events of D-Day. And one of the scenes in the movie, of course, was at this square, and they showed this fire. And so that was a legitimate thing. That actually did happen. But that wasn't a planned fire. It happened. That building happened to go up in flames.
Yes, it was just a coincidence. Probably also it was one of the reasons of the mistake. Maybe some pilots thought that it was a landmark. Maybe we don't know exactly why they parachute the stick on the square of Saint-Mary-Glis. Very difficult to say. But probably 12 American paratroopers land here on the square, and probably half were killed by the Germans.
And this wasn't the designated landing zone for the paratroopers. Can you describe kind of the reason why there were misdrops in that operation?
There were misdrops because some of the pilots were inexperienced. There was a low cloud cover over Normandy. They weren't able to watch. They weren't able to see the landmarks that were so necessary on this moonlit night to find out where they needed to drop. They weren't dropping in daytime. They were dropping at night. Combined with that low cloud cover and the inexperience of some of the pilots, they mistook drop zones. They were mistaken as to where some of these drop zones were located.
And so we know they were scattered all around. As Dom said, about 12 or so paratroopers landed here, and then it was just kind of wetland all around. And of course, then those paratroopers They had to try to formulate so that they go execute the plan because of the strategic interest of this area to secure the causeways, the crossroads, so that that peninsula could be protected and the reinforcements of the Germans wouldn't come in. This is a great opportunity to take a break here. We'll come back and we'll talk more about Sainte Mary Glace. This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum. Located at Camp Ripley, the museum strengthens public understanding of how armed conflict and military institutions have shaped Minnesota's and the nation's experience. Minnesotans are mobilizing to build a new world-class military and veterans museum at Camp Ripley, opening in 2026. More information at mnvetmuseum.org. Thank you, Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. We're in Sainte Mary Glace, France, commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. I'm joined by my co-host. I've got the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, and noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. So I'm standing in the square, as I had mentioned previously, in Sainte Mary Glace. And as you can hear by the tolls in the background, we're standing in front of a church. It's called the Holy Mother of Peace Church right here in the town square. And Dom, I want to talk to you because there's some significance about this church. As I'm looking up at the church, there's still a paratrooper that is stuck up near the steeple there. And, obviously it's not a real person. It's commemorating somebody that was actually stuck on that church. And anybody who saw the movie The Longest Day, they would have seen that scene. Can you tell us a little bit about who that represents and kind of what the importance it is of this?
Yes, that's to commemorate a paratrooper. His name was John Steele. And as a private, John Steele came down to Earth. The air was thick with flak and truss of fire from which he received a wound to his foot. Unable to control his descent, he found himself swinging in his parachute harness and heading directly from the church steeple. There, on the central tower of the church, his parachute snagged on a stone pinnacle and still found himself hanging, unable to move from the church tower. Beneath him, the Germans continued to slaughter the paratroopers that were landing all around them.
And so John Steele is stuck up there, and it takes a little while. Somebody has to get him down. How does he finally get down from there?
So he was suspended to his parachute harness. He was unable to free himself, and so decided to feign death by hanging motionless, hoping that no German would bother to waste any bullets on his seemingly lifeless body. Later, the two Germans in the belfry of the church freed him from his parachute and made him a prisoner of war.
So, obviously, John Steele, he survived. He was a prisoner. He was later released. Yeah. And then he came back to town at a later date and kind of turned into somewhat of a hero, didn't he?
Yes. He came back at the beginning of the 60s. And when the local people heard that he was John Steele, the paratrooper of the steeple, he became the local hero. So a restaurant named after him, a street, and he used to come back every year. Unfortunately, he passed away in 1969. And so we was very sad for the local people because he was really the first veteran to come back and the local hero.
And so, Doug, I want to come back to you. We've got Minnesota stories to continue to tell. And there's somebody that I'd like for you to talk a little bit about. This is another person from Minnesota, but from Minneapolis. Can you tell us a little bit about Bud?
Sure. Clarence Bud Olam was a member of the 82nd Airborne's 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment. This was Bud's third combat jump in World War II. This was not new to him. He had been in combat before. He was a seasoned soldier. He was actually a runner for the headquarters company, the 505th. Bud had the distinction on D-Day, or shortly after D-Day, of saving his regimental commander's life, Colonel Ekman, and the famed General Jim Gavin. They were walking down a hedgerow-covered road, and a German machine gun opened up on them. Bud selflessly charged through the hedgerow, killed the Germans on this machine gun crew, and scattered the rest of them. For those actions, General Gavin recommended and awarded him this Silver Star for gallantry. So Bud had been there before, he had seen action, and he was one of those paratroopers who was able to instantly react to the situation, and one of many of hundreds of acts of bravery that day that helped carry the airborne troops for that day. So,
and another person from the 82nd Airborne Division now is a Minnesota service member as well, and a soldier by the name of Albert Larson. Tell us where he's from and tell us a little bit about his story.
Sure. So Albert Larson was from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He was also a member of the 505th, and this was also his third combat jump in World War II. Albert dropped just southwest of the town of Saint-Mère-Église, one of the few airborne drops that actually had a concentrated drop and was successful. Albert was severely wounded in Normandy as he was crawling across the field. A German machine gun clipped the bottom of his boot. So this boot has a nice bullet groove on it. That boot's actually now in the possession of the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum. So we'll have that on display someday. Albert was evacuated to England, like so many other of the hundreds and thousands of paratroopers who were wounded on D-Day, and was able to fight later on in the war as well. And he came home after the war, had a good life as a union worker in Minneapolis, and lived a good long life after the war.
And another connection with the 101st Airborne Division is James Carroll.
Yes, so James Carroll landed near Carrolltown, and he didn't have any trouble, but he was lost. And he remember when I did the interview of him, he remembers the famous ceremony at Carrolltown on the 13th of June, just after the liberation of the town by the paratroopers of the 101st Airborne. And during this ceremony on the public square, probably some collaborators, and we don't know exactly why, but sent the information to the German artillery that there was a concentration of American paratroopers at Carrolltown, and they fire during the ceremony. And a few paratroopers were wounded, but one little girl of eight years old was killed by the explosion of one shell on Carrolltown.
And here in Saint-Mère-Église, this was the first town liberated by the Americans, right?
Yes. Yes, Saint-Mère-Église became, I would say, one of the first towns liberated by the American and by the Allied. And I think the first American embassy was at Saint-Mère-Église. And yes, so it became very famous after the war, because it was the first American town liberated.
So we have like a minute and a half here in this segment left, and I want to round out this segment on Saint-Mère-Église on the importance, right? So what next? It happened. They came. They liberated this town. But, Doug, what happened next? How was the stage set for the future?
Okay, so the liberation, the capture of Saint-Mère-Église wasn't an end unto itself. That was just the first stage of having this crossroads town where they were able to protect these causeways that were coming in from the beach, and eventually cut off the Contentin Peninsula and work their way up to the Port of Cherbourg. The Port of Cherbourg was of extreme strategic importance because loading supplies off of Utah Beach was going to work for a little while, but they really needed a major port. That major port was in Cherbourg. When they eventually captured Cherbourg, they were able to greatly, significantly increase the amount of supplies that they were able to bring in, vehicles, food, ammunition, reinforcements. And when they drove through to liberate France later on, Cherbourg was the main supply point for that effort.
We know that, you know, there were the missed drops of the airborne paratroopers, but, you know, this is all about training. No one knew what the objective was. They were able to collect themselves. They were able to secure, liberate the town, and really set the stage for the future.
It did. Being that the 82nd and the 101st were fairly elite troops, they were highly motivated. They were eager to get the job done. They were eager to end this operation and continue on.
This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio here in Saint-Marie-Glise, France. Please stay with us and we'll be right back. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580. The post is a pillar of the community and lives up to the vision of continuing service to our country through service to the community. American Legion Chanhassen Post 580 was formed in 1952 by World War II veterans. Sponsorship of our commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day honors their memory and sends a clear message that they will support veterans, service members, and military families of all eras. Thank you, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham, and continuing our commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day. And we're at a different location now, and you know, as we talk about the things, the events of D-Day, many sites are well known when we talk about Omaha or Utah or Point de Hoc, but we're in a location now that isn't generally talked about, and something really significant happened here. Some might even say that it was a war crime. And that's in Grenne. So we are still in Normandy, the area of Grenne. And joining me, continuing this conversation, are my fellow co-hosts, again, the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, and also noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. And Dominique, I really want to start with you. I had said that, you know, something significant happened here, and some might even call it a war crime. And I mean, we're standing right now inside of a very notable terrain feature, and that being the church. And maybe you can kind of set up a little bit for us the significance of this area in knowing that there was an airborne troops were supposed to be landing some 20 miles away from here, but yet they landed right outside of Grenne, and they were attracted to all come to this church, and that's when things started to unfold. So if you could please share with us a little bit about that.
Yes, thank you about that. Yes, Grenne was a little village in World War II. 650 people live here. They were fortunate that the town was not occupied by the Germans, so it was a very quiet village. But to come back to the 507th, which was a regiment of the 82nd Airborne, who was supposed to land at around Saint-Merglise, for some reason, difficult to know why, some of them were parachuted 20 miles south of their drop zone where they were supposed to land. And on the morning of D-Day, 165 American paratroopers land on this area, on this flooded area. We think that it's probably a mistake of the pilots and the jump master, who probably made the mistake with the landmark with the Murderer River. And when they saw the Toad Canal, they saw that it was the Murderer River. Seems very similar. And they put the green light and the paratroopers jump here. And unfortunately, they arrive on this flooded area. And the only thing that they were able to see on the morning of D-Day was this little church at the top of this hill. And they decided to walk on that direction. And on the morning of D-Day, you had 165 paratroopers arriving in this village. And when the Major Johnson, who was in charge of this company, asked to the mayor of the town where he was and show him his map, the mayor said, "Unfortunately, you are outside your map. You are not on the map." And they were 20 miles from their drop zone. So it was the beginning of this story. It was decided, the major decided that they would start the war here at Grenes and won't try to join their regiment at Amfreville. And it's what they did. They organized a perimeter around the village with the help of the civilians who feed them, and which was not easy because with all the food restrictions, they didn't have too much to eat. But they succeed to find some food. They kill a cow to feed all these young Americans. And some of the civilians help them to find the bundles that they lost during the drop, find the machine guns, the ammunition we have been lost in the water. And all together, they succeed to organize a halamo. And during a few days, the village stay quiet. Everything was well organized. And then the Germans heard about something about what's going on at Grenes, and they sent a patrol with a motorcycle. And the perimeter was on alert, and they shot the Germans. So now the Germans at Saint-Jean-Day, where was the headquarters, knew that something big was at Grenes. So on the Sunday, on Sunday morning, some of the paratroopers were in the church with some civilians, and they received the alert that some Germans were arrived. And they were some SS of the 17th Airborne Division, 17th SS Division. And so it was the beginning of a big battle. During all the days, they fought bravely. As I've said before, Doug, they were well-trained, they were brave, and they succeed to keep the perimeter. But unfortunately, they were short in ammunition at the end of the day. They had a lot of wounded, and they had lost some of their men. Major Johnson had been killed in his commanding post. So it was decided to leave, and to leave the wounded soldier in the church, which became an aid station. And the surgeon, Captain Abraham Sofian, decided to stay with his wounded and with his medics, and with two priests and two housekeepers, they took care of the wounded. On the same time, the other succeed to escape by this way, and arrive in the middle of the night in a farm where they were able later to take a boat with some farmers. The tragedy was when the SS arrived in the church, they moved the wounded and they executed them. Some were executed in that field and bayoneted. Some others were put in a truck and were executed about 2 kilometers from here in the field. And we have heard that some of them have had to dig themselves their own graves. And the two priests were executed with the two housekeepers. And of course, they executed also Abraham Sofian and his medics. So.
And we're standing here, like I said, in the church. Only the steeple remains, so it's wide open. We can walk right through it, open air, and in what would be in the back, the sacristy, I guess. That's where the remains of the two priests are.
Yes, yes. You can still see this stone with their names. And it was a tragedy, yeah.
And, of course, this area here, pretty significant terrain, because as we look out over the horizon, we are on that high ground. And I can just imagine how bad it was for those troops that had landed in the field that I'm looking at. It would have been flooded. And of course, you had mentioned before that many of the young soldiers couldn't even swim, and that weighed in the decision to keep them here, didn't it?
Exactly. Because there was not a friction, but they were not agree. Major Johnson wanted to start the war here, and his captain, Captain Broomit, thought that the mission was to try to join their regiment at Amfreville. But as Major Johnson said, you know, we most of our men doesn't know to swim. They have never swim, and we might be have some problem to go through the flooded area with all our equipment, and it can be very dangerous for our men.
And we know that the townspeople came together to provide shelter, to provide some aid, provide some food, but it wasn't going to last long, one, because of the low supplies, and then what this area was trying to defend, and that would have been the SS. And we'll talk about the SS in the next segment, because we want to hear a little bit about what the difference is on that. And then that ties into another really good story that Doug is going to share with us. So thanks for giving us the background on this important area and a story not well known throughout D-Day here at Grin in Normandy. This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We will be right back. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, DAV of Minnesota. With more than 19,000 members and 32 chapters across the state, DAV of Minnesota was built on the concept of veterans serving veterans. DAV of Minnesota provides a network of services and leads the way to provide a lifetime of services to veterans of all military branches and eras. DAV of Minnesota fulfills our nation's promises to the men and women who served. Thank you, DAV of Minnesota, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. Continue the conversation in Grin, and I've got, again, my co-host with me, the curator of Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, and noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. You know, Doug, as we're sitting here and hearing the story that Dom shared with us about, you know, the troopers that landed. It was a mislanding, but, you know, they made the best of the situation, as, you know, soldiers are supposed to do. They come up, they see the high ground, and they come into this church. We talked a little bit about what some might consider to be war crimes. But what I want to start with you on is, you know, we're in this high ground, and Dom had mentioned, and we talked about the fact that that field out there was flooded, and there was a concern with young soldiers not knowing how to swim, which is part of the reason why they stayed here. But that wasn't flooded as in because of all the rain and it would be normally full of water. It was actually purposely flooded, and there's some reason behind that. And I wonder if you might be able to talk us through why that was in that condition.
Sure. Well, as we sit here in this really bucolic spot today, you can't imagine what happened back in 1944 during these times. But Grin is set on a very high hill. As we're looking out over this plain surrounding Grin, you can see for miles and miles. It's a very strategic in as much as you can really see for a long ways. But all of these fields out here, as Dom mentioned, were flooded. So when the Germans were trying to set up anti-airborne landings early in June, there were some the locks at Barquette in Carentan were closed. And what that did was that forced all of these rivers to overflow their banks, and it created a hazard for airborne troops. They couldn't land gliders. They couldn't land paratroopers. It would have made it very difficult for the invaders here. So as Dom mentioned earlier, the 507th was dropped almost 20 miles out of their original drop zone, and they landed in these fields here. Some soldiers drowned out there. It wasn't all that deep in a lot of places, so they really needed to converge here on the church. Now, why was Grin so important? As Dom mentioned earlier, how the Colonel or Major Taylor wanted to bring the troops here. Carentan was of extreme strategic importance on the invasion. It was the one town where they can link up Utah Beach with Omaha Beach. They needed a link up at Carentan. They needed to capture Carentan to create one continuous front. So from Sword Beach, way on the eastern end of the invasion land area, to Utah Beach, they would have one unified front to be able to push inland. Their stand here, their five-day stand here at Gren, kept the 17th SS Division from reaching Carentan and breaking up that much-needed hookup between Utah and Omaha Beach.
What's the difference? As we talk about, normal German soldiers, this is different, though,
yes.
This SS group.
Yeah, so the Waffen-SS were very highly indoctrinated. They were Hitler's quote-unquote super soldiers. They were very dedicated to the cause of Nazism. They were vicious. They were extremely determined. They were the bad guys that were notable during the war for committing a lot of war crimes, as Dom so eloquently alluded to earlier. They were the soldiers that were going to get the job done and take no moral consideration into how they got that job done.
Okay, so then you talked about that SS group is, in between what then is Utah and beaches down the road.
Yes.
And this was important land because it could prevent them or deter them from moving.
Yes, and the paratroopers that were here at Gren, they didn't understand the strategic overview of how important it was that they did what they did. And they only found out later after they got to Carentan that they had held this unit back and made it possible for the link up of Omaha and Utah Beach and created that safe space for that union to happen.
Now, I do want to make sure we have time to talk about our Minnesota tie here. And we're standing in the area where this soldier would have been on that Sunday morning praying and during Mass. And then something happened, and that was the announcement that the Germans were coming.
Yes, John Hinchliff, all of his friends and family call him Jack, so I'm going to continue to call him Jack from here on, was a machine gunner with the 507th. Our radio viewers can't see it, but right to the edge of the church, there was a big open field, and it was the only way that the Germans could get through Gren. John had set up his machine gun on one side of this field, and another machine gunner had set up on the other side of this field and created what we would call a kill zone, with hundreds of German soldiers, SS soldiers, running across this field. John and the other machine gunner, as well as support units like mortarmen, were cutting down these Germans crossing this field. Jack called it a machine gunner's dream. They killed a lot of Germans. Unfortunately, they started to run out of ammunition, and at one point, the paratroopers were out of ammunition, mortar ammunition. They had to get out of Gren and escape because they weren't going to be able to hold off without any ammunition. So unfortunately, they had to evacuate Gren. They had to leave the village and their wounded and the civilians that had done so much to help them. And they made their way to Carentan, again with the help of some of the French civilians of Gren that would take them out in boats or show them the way to get to Carentan through the flooded areas. And they got into Carentan a day or two later, not knowing the strategic importance of the role that they played here at Gren.
And they actually delayed then that German SS group enough to cause a little bit of a disruption in, future movements.
Yes, so the 17th SS eventually made it to Carentan, but they made it there too late. The link-up had already occurred. Enough reinforcements from Utah and Omaha had poured into the area that they secured that much-needed link-up between Utah and Omaha Beach and made it possible for future operations to cut off the Carentan Peninsula and eventually make their way to Cherbourg. So that small action, that small tactical action, had a very larger strategic importance attached to it.
And so it's just interesting, kind of how things work out. This wasn't supposed to be the landing zone. it ended up being one of the landing zones. Those troopers stay here, and they end up having a significant impact on the battle to allow that link-up that you talked about, which was so desperately needed.
Yeah, you know, of all the many airborne misdrops on June 6th, this was one of the most fortuitous of those misdrops. There were, and all these misdrops really confused the Germans as to what was happening that day. They didn't know where the main effort was going to be for these airborne operations. You had the 507th, which was 20 miles away from their drop zone. You know, in many ways, a pessimist would say that it was a failure of the operation. But you know, you get a lemon, you turn it into lemonade, right? And they were able to turn that situation around, which could be disheartening to another commander. And they really used that American spirit to really turn that situation around for the airborne unit. So,
well, I think just a very important story to tell. You know, something that isn't spoken about frequently. Not many people know of Gren. Like I mentioned before, they know of all of the other, the beachheads and the big things. So final thoughts, Doug?
Yeah, you know, I really want to applaud our friend and co-host here, Dom. The story of Gren was largely unknown up until this point. And through the efforts of Dom, who wrote a book on the subject, this story, which was a minor footnote in the story of Normandy, really, he really brought out the strategic importance of this event.
Yeah, thank you so much, both of you, for sharing your knowledge about this important and strategic site. This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio.